Good afternoon. I will call the meeting of the Environmental and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee to order. We do have a quorum. At this point in time, we have two sets of minutes to approve. We do need to take official action on the April 10th, 2025 minutes. Representative Purcell, would you like to move those minutes?
So moved.
Representative Purcell moves the minutes from April 10th, 2025. Are there any changes or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motions are approved. Representative Purcell, we have the February 19th, 2026 minutes. Would you like to move those for approval?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Purcell moves the minutes for February 19th, 2026. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed? Motion approved. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome today. We are having a day of several different presentations. The first part of the day is going to be focusing on water and how water works in our state, rules and regulations and statutes that govern them to help give us more of an understanding of what's going on there. So as a result, we've got some folks from the DNR that are going to be joining us today. So I would like to ask them to come forward at this point in time. We have Jason Meckel and Ellen Constantine, who will be doing a presentation for us. We do have a packet of the slide deck also in our folders today. And with that, I am going to imagine it'll probably be Mr. Meckel that will start us off. If you'd like to introduce yourself and who you're with and start your presentation, please.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. Jason Meckel, Department of Natural Resources. I'm the Assistant Division Director for Ecological and Water Resources.
And we also then have Ms. Considine, if you'd like to introduce yourself.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Ellen Considine, Supervisor of the Groundwater Technical Analysis Unit at the Department of Natural Resources.
Awesome. Thank you. Mr. Meckel, if you'd like to go ahead, please.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for the invitation to be here and tell you about what's been going on in groundwater Minnesota. It was about 12 to 15 years ago. We had a number of hearings in the House and the Senate about groundwater resources, and some of the things you're going to hear about today are the fruits of those bodies passing some budget initiatives and things that have helped us to do some things. So we'll try to touch on as many of those things as we can. It's going to be fairly high level, going to go fairly quickly, but we do have a couple of examples that we're going to use to just sort of illustrate some of the challenges that we see that we're faced with in Minnesota. And I want to start there. The number one thing we have to understand is that our aquifers don't follow our neat lines, boundaries. They don't follow county boundaries. They don't follow municipal boundaries. They don't even follow watershed boundaries. They kind of have a mind of their own, as it were. And the glaciers left us with sort of a mix in much of the state. The other challenges that we have is that not all of our aquifers have been mapped. We don't have good chemistry data on all of our aquifers. We don't have great age data on all of the water in our aquifers. So this is especially difficult in northwestern Minnesota, and Ellen's going to provide some really, in western Minnesota, I should say, Ellen's going to give you some good examples of that. The other thing that we're seeing is a lot of the growth and expansion in water use, of groundwater especially, is happening in places that are kind of already water stressed. And so we're going to talk throughout the day here a little bit about what do we mean by water stressed? What does that look like? How does that show up? The other thing that we want to point out is that plans for growth and expansion seem to be pretty dynamic and change pretty rapidly. You know, 15 years ago when we were here talking about groundwater resources and the legislature was approving funds for us to do some work, we weren't even talking about data centers. We weren't talking about some of the large dairies. We weren't talking about biofuels. So, you know, things change, and those are some of the challenges that we're dealing with is trying to support those industries. And then the other thing I wanted to really illustrate, and again, back 15 years ago, we talked a lot about this, but what are the constraints that we have on our uses of water? And we think about those as limits. When we issue a permit, we issue that permit for a finite amount of water, a limit, a number, over a year's time. But as we think about our resources, we really have to think about those as sort of ranges of risk. And so we want to talk a little bit about, like, what is it that we're factoring into when we're making these decisions? So with that, I just want to orient you all to a couple of things about how do we use groundwater in the state of Minnesota. So on the left is the blue dots, the state. Those are the community water supply wells. Every county in this state has at least one community water supply well somewhere. On the right, we are showing irrigation permits. Now, the green ones, I know on your printed version, you probably can't see the colors, but on the screen, the green dots are the agriculture crop irrigation permits. The red, which you see centered a lot around the Twin Cities, are non-crop irrigation. And then the purple dots you can see mostly in the northern part of the state are wild rice irrigation. This just gives you a sense of the distribution. And these are high capacity wells. This is not the private well, you know, that you have for a home. These are wells that are 8 or 10 inches or 12 inches and larger that can pump hundreds of million or hundreds of gallons per minute. So I want to talk a little bit about climatic drivers and what we're seeing. So this slide is showing over the last 15 years what are known as wet cycles and dry cycles. These are things that show up in the drought monitor. I know over the last few years we were all paying attention to the drought monitor and we were seeing how much the oranges were turning to reds and so forth and the stress that was causing for farmers and others. But we are in the wettest period of record for this state. So the last 30 years have been wetter than any other period of time in the state of Minnesota. And on average, we're seeing about 4 inches of more rainfall on an average annual basis. Now that's an average. Northern Minnesota has not been seeing 4 inches, it's more like 1 and 2. Southern and eastern Minnesota has been seeing more than 4 inches. But what's also different is that rainfall is tending to come in bigger storms. So the additional 4 inches has shown up as a 4-inch rain, or a 3-inch rain, or a couple of 2-inch rains. And those aren't necessarily conducive to the ways in which we use water, right? We use water during the summer months to make up for what rain doesn't provide for us. So you can just see the intensity of these droughts and how we're oscillating from wet cycles and dry cycles. Parts of this state have experienced record floods in the spring and have turned around and had near record drought later in that summer. And it's changing the way we're using our water. The next slide is going to illustrate this. So on this one, we're showing the groundwater use by different categories. So I'll orient you to the graph, first of all, the dotted line, which is the highest line on the graph for most of this period of time from 1980s to now, is our public water supplies. So that's going to all those community water supply wells that we showed on the map earlier. That solid line that's in the middle that's trending upward over time but oscillates quite a bit, that's our irrigation line. The dashed line below that is industrial processing, and it's not obvious, but that has actually trended downward over time. It's not a huge component of our groundwater use. It's roughly 20 million gallons a year, but it's pretty steady, but it's been trending downward. And then the other is sort of the catch-all category for all the other things. What I'm illustrating on this map with these arrows is that those arrows correspond to some of our driest periods, our droughts. And what you can see from that is it spikes our water use. And this is important because what we're seeing now in the most recent decade is that our spikes in water use are greatly exceeding the historic ranges, particularly in the last couple of years that we've had some droughts and our agricultural irrigation has really increased. And for the first time, ag irrigation water use has surpassed that of municipal water supply, which has generally been trending somewhat downward for quite a while, as you can see from that graph. So I want to talk a little bit about our strategies for managing this resource. In 2013, as the legislature was allocating additional funds for us to do work, we developed a strategic plan, and we categorized those things into these 7 areas. And that is to, first of all, heighten the priority that we give to our groundwater, to enhance the information available for our making decisions, to improve our management of appropriation permits, improve compliance with permits and regulations, improve education and communication, addressing challenges in areas of high use, and promoting water conservation. So what I wanted to do was just give you a couple of examples in how we've been able to do that. And I also want to point out that the Clean Water Fund has played a critical role in this as well. So we use a combination largely of the Clean Water Fund, the water management fees that are generated from the use, the application, and the permit fees, some general fund, the groundwater general fund in particular, specific allocation, as well as the Environment and Natural Resource Trust Fund, all contribute to various aspects of the work that we do as part of managing this resource on behalf of the state of Minnesota. The Environment and Natural Resource Trust Fund has helped us with the county geologic atlases primarily, although it does get supplemented a little bit with Clean Water Fund. The Groundwater General Fund and the Clean Water Fund have helped us to double the size of our groundwater monitoring network in the last 10 years. We've been able to build a new online permitting system that makes us more efficient and helps our applicants get all the information in one time and submit it so that we can process applications, complete applications more quickly. We've been doing a lot of communication and outreach, various forums and stakeholder groups. We've had groundwater management areas. We've done lots of presentations and educational materials presented in those places as well as others. And we've been working to address some of the challenges in these high use areas. And some of the ones that I'm going to come back to later in the presentation, I'll just mention here, are our groundwater management areas like White Bear Lake, Bonanza Valley, Straight River, or Little Rock Creek, and several other parts of the state where we have either surpassed what we think are the sustainable limits of use, or we might be approaching the sustainable limits of use. And that presents all kinds of challenges about how do we balance out all these different uses and follow the statutes and the statutory priority and support, hopefully, a growing and healthy economy. And so some of the examples that you'll see here will help us to illustrate that. All right, and I think from here, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Ellen Considine.
All right, thank you. Mr. Chair and members, before I go further, I really want to acknowledge that there are four state agencies overseeing groundwater regulation in Minnesota. So as you can see on the screen, the Department of Agriculture, the Pollution Control Agency, and the Department of Health are largely responsible for regulating groundwater quality. Right, so things like PFAS, things like lead, herbicides, gasoline leaks. At DNR, we are responsible for regulating how much groundwater is used, as Jason mentioned. So the quantity and the quality definitely intersect, and we do collaborate with other agencies when we get to those intersections. For today, I really just want to focus on the quantity piece. So in the state of Minnesota, if anyone is going to use more than 10,000 gallons a day of water, whether that's surface water or groundwater, or 1 million gallons a year, they need a water appropriation permit from the DNR. To obtain a water appropriation permit, you would need to apply for a permit, and you would tell DNR how much water you want to use and where you're getting it from. Like, do you want it from surface water? Do you want it from groundwater? When we receive those groundwater permit applications, we compare what is being requested and where it's being requested to the groundwater sustainability statute. And you can see the key parts of that are highlighted on the screen. So this is 103G.287. And we're looking for four things when we evaluate those permit applications. The statute requires that we can only issue a permit if it is leaving groundwater for future generations. It requires that we cannot issue a permit if it will degrade ecosystems. We cannot issue a permit if it will lower groundwater levels below the reach of domestic or municipal wells. And we need to make sure that water quality will not be degraded. So these are the rules that apply wherever you are in Minnesota, right? But if nothing else, what I want you to take home today is the image that's on the screen right now. Although those are the rules that we apply everywhere in Minnesota, groundwater is not distributed equally across the state. So this map shows our six groundwater provinces, and they're ranked in order of most available groundwater to least available groundwater. You can see that we're sitting right now today in the yellow in Groundwater Province 1 in the metro area, and this is where we have the most available groundwater in the state. It is not unlimited, but we have fairly abundant aquifers here. So for reference, we're sitting on several hundred feet of aquifer, and if you hired a well driller, you could go almost anywhere in Groundwater Province 1 and you would find groundwater. The other end of the spectrum is up on the North Shore. In the northeast part of the state, Groundwater Province 6, shown on the map. Most communities along the North Shore get their municipal supply from Lake Superior because there is very, very little groundwater there. At the DNR, we lately are spending a lot of our time in Groundwater Province 5. Here, groundwater is very limited. So it's not quite so dire as always having to go to a lake. But for context, I described that in the metro area, we have hundreds of feet of aquifer, and you could encounter groundwater almost wherever you drilled. In province 5, the aquifers tend to be tens of feet thick. And if you drill a well, you might not find groundwater. So if you live out in the western or northwest or south part of the state, you probably know this. For example, it has happened where a farmer or a municipal supplier will drill on one side of a field and find an aquifer, and on the other side of the field, they will not find an aquifer. And that's why in the southwest and western parts of the state, we have rural water supply districts. They find where there is groundwater, and then they pipe it out across many counties to people's homes. We are finding that in some places in western Minnesota, we may not be meeting that first part of the sustainability standard that says we need to leave groundwater for future generations. So how do we know this? One of the things we can do as we're keeping an eye on our groundwater is we use that observation well network that Jason mentioned. So the DNR has over 1,000 wells in our observation well network. And I think of these as like monitoring the pulse of the aquifer. So they're monitoring the water level in the aquifer. And the wells that I'm showing on the map here, these are wells where we have data that goes back 20 years. And so we can calculate a trend. We can see our groundwater levels going up. Are they stable? Are they going down? And you'll see that there are a lot of gray circles on the map, and those are the good news. That's where water levels are generally stable over the last 20 years. The green triangles show where groundwater levels are trending upward, as Jason mentioned, although we've had some recent droughts, on the whole, the last 20 years have been pretty wet. Today, I want to focus on the blue triangles. This is where groundwater levels are trending downward. And so those are flags that we may not be leaving groundwater for future generations in those places. And in particular, I want to draw your attention up to the far northwest part of the state, way up in Marshall County, the far northwest blue square. We're going to zoom in and just take a look at that. I learned from stories. I assume other people do too. So I'll tell you a story about what's happening in Marshall County, where the little city of Warren sits. So here's the data that we are seeing. I'm a scientist. I was always going to bring data today. And along the top, you can see those purple dots. And the purple dots show groundwater levels going back about 40 years, so going back to the early 80s. And you can see that the dots are trending downward over the last 40 years. And then when you look on the lower part, you can see the bars going up, up, up every year. And that's groundwater use. So what we're seeing in the Warren Aquifer, is that groundwater levels are trending downward. And this data only goes through 22. Groundwater levels have continued falling since then. I should mention that. As water use is going up. So it seems very likely here that our groundwater withdrawals are exceeding how much is available. Because you can imagine that we could let this go on for a little while, but if we let this go on indefinitely, we are not leaving water for future generations. So we are actively studying this area right now. We're looking into it. It appears likely that this area around Warren, Minnesota, is experiencing what we call a water use conflict. This is a term laid out in Rule 6115.0740. And we call it a water use conflict when demand exceeds the supply. And when that happens, the first step is for the DNR to figure out how much groundwater is actually available. So we have to figure out, like, what is the size of the pie? And after that, the users need to figure out how they're going to share the pie. So you can imagine if we had two users, they might decide, well, this is how much water is available, and we're going to share it equally. But, and I'm sure you all know this, but I need to say it because I run into a lot of confusion, especially in western Minnesota, we are not a water rights state. So that means we are not first in time, first in right. If a new user were to come to the system, they would need to get a slice of the pie too. So as new users keep coming into the system, everybody gets a slightly smaller piece of the pie. So this is something that we have been navigating the water use conflict in Little Rock Creek there because groundwater use is negatively impacting a trout stream. Here, I foresee that we're going to be navigating a water use conflict because we're simply not leaving groundwater for future generations. So I did want to bring up one of the challenges we're encountering in Warren. which is again in Marshall County and elsewhere in western and northwest Minnesota, is that we don't have completed geologic maps everywhere. I don't want to lead you to believe that we do not have geologic data. We do. But it is when we are evaluating permit applications in these locations that do not have the geologic atlases completed by the Minnesota Geological Survey and the DNR, it is as though we are flying in the fog. We're not totally blind. We still have information, but we have to go more slowly because the aquifers have not been mapped ahead of time. The situation in Warren, Minnesota also brings in another concept we wanted to talk about today, which is our water use priorities in Minnesota. In Minnesota, we have water use priorities in case of a shortage. So domestic water supply is the first priority. As you can see, ag and irrigation processing are the third priority. Consumptive number five is like industrial and commercial uses, but the thing to take away is that domestic water supply is the first priority. So if there's not enough water to go around, we meet domestic needs first. This comes into play when we have very dry summers. So Jason mentioned we've had a couple drought years lately. And when there is a drought, when there's a lack of rain, people respond by pumping a lot more groundwater to keep our lawns and our crops alive. It keeps businesses viable. But when that happens, that pumping at higher rates than usual does lower the water levels in the aquifer, and sometimes it can cause domestic wells to go out of water. So the map that I'm showing on the left side of the screen is where the DNR received out-of-water complaints during the drought in 2021, and you'll see there's a lot of pink triangles up in the northwest part of the state. That's where the drought was most severe. And in fact, we learned that the city of Warren that summer was close to running out of water. So we did have to suspend a couple nearby ag irrigation permits because they were lower priority and we needed to be sure that the city did not run out of water. In 2022, we got a different flavor of well interferences. This was just north of us now in the North Metro in Anoka County. We got we got out of water calls from well owners in Ham Lake, where you can see all the green dots are on the map. And the DNR, we investigated and we found that those domestic wells had been run out of water by pumping in the nearby city of Blaine. So Blaine's municipal wells caused those domestic wells to go out of water. And that brings me to one of the last pains that I wanted to just make you aware of today, the things that are kind of on our mind at DNR, and that is the Metro Fringe. So this is a map that I borrowed from the Metropolitan Council, and you can see it shows our 7-county metro area, and the dark green communities are the ones that are growing the fastest, and they're called out by the dashed white line. This is where we're seeing the most growth. That white line coincides with where we saw the well interferences in Blaine and Ham Lake. It also coincides with where we had a large cluster of well interferences about 20 years ago in the South Metro. So this is an area that's on our radar. As cities are growing, putting in municipal wells immediately adjacent to communities that are relying on individual domestic wells, it will put more pressure on those domestic wells. And I think we're running low on time. Jason, can I hand it back to you?
You can do it.
Keep going? Okay. Our statute also requires, I'll just kind of go through these last points quickly, our statute does require that we cannot issue a groundwater appropriation permit if it will negatively impact an ecosystem. So in Minnesota, we value our lakes and our wetlands, our streams, and in particular, we know that trout streams and a type of wetland called a calcareous fen, these are particularly susceptible to groundwater pumping. So we find I often urge appropriators to stay away from those features. And I should mention that lest you be alarmed by the size of the blue dots on the calcareous fen map, most calcareous fens are less than 4 acres in size. I just had to make the dots big enough so you could see them. Jason, I'll hand it back to you.
Okay, so taking all those things into consideration, a number of years ago, we started to develop what we called an areas of concern map. And last year, we've updated that map, and I think you have a handout with the map, and then each of those items on the map is numbered, and there's a description that goes with it to tell you what's going on. We're not going to cover all of those today because there's a lot of spaces on there, but just wanted to point out that it represents these issues of well interference. Those are creating areas of concern. It represents issues where we have limited aquifers and we're seeing an increased interest in expanding business opportunities, whether it's, you name it, whatever type of water use. Or in our metropolitan area where we're experienced, like in the North and East Metro, both a water level issue with White Bear Lake, but also contamination issues. The Bonanza Valley groundwater management area, we've got a groundwater model that's in development so that we can look at what we think mostly there will be potential for wetland impacts. We recently completed some analysis on the Strait River, and the University of Minnesota is now conducting a groundwater model analysis up in the Pineland Sands, so we'll learn more about that. So this gives you a sense that all across the state, there are places where we're experiencing some kind of water stress that constrains opportunities and it creates challenges and sets up for conflicts. And these are things that, as a state, we're going to be navigating. We have been and will continue to navigate. And with that, I think we'll stand for some questions, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you for the presentations. We have a couple of folks with questions already, so we'll start off with Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation, first of all. I know, especially from our conversation, Mr. Chair, that this was designed as educational to the public and to the members, and it's so important when we consider Minnesota's water. And just from this perspective, we always want to make sure that we have the full picture, the full story, which I know that you're committed to, Mr. Chair. So thank you, first off, to you. Secondarily, to the members, a large section of my district is cited inside of this report. As it relates to the Little Rock Creek, and a slide was just before this that they moved past. But I also want to counter what the DNR is sharing with you and understand that they aren't giving you the full picture. And what I want to say around that, specifically as it relates to the Little Rock Creek, is their basis for what they're talking about and their management in the area is all based around the fact that it's currently named a trout stream in rules here in Minnesota. The Little Rock Creek is not a native trout stream. It is a stream that the DNR has stocked and is in rule a trout stream. But if you talk to the people who have lived there and have been there for generations, like my family and like countless others, this trout stream, currently labeled as such, was not native place for trout. And I invite you to join me on my legislation, House File 1841, to remove this as a trout stream because it's not representative of my community, especially when it is the thing that is dictating their groundwater management in the area. Further, on this very note, this same watershed is one that currently today, despite droughts, despite the references to the stream, that stream, well before irrigation in my community, was one that in time of drought would run dry. And even in times where there was an abundance of water, there is still a time, often in the middle of summer, where that stream bed would run dry. And I mention that because the actual aquifer, the DNR cannot point to any specific evidence to say that despite all of the permitted wells within the area, that particular watershed has not been negatively impacted long term. It has always recharged and it has continued to support the economy in my community. So it's important for us, and I appreciate this opportunity to share with you a fuller picture that wasn't presented today. With that in mind, I wanted to ask to the DNR, when considering the range of different funding mechanisms that you shared with us, from the increased fees which were brought on users beginning for this year, and then looking at your additional funding mechanisms from the Clean Water Fund, the ENTF fund, what is the cost to taxpayers for the current groundwater sustainability programs? And following that, how are you evaluating return on investment?
Mr. Meckel, will that be you tackling that one?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I, at the risk of being wrong, I don't have those numbers in my head, but we'd be happy to follow up with what the various funding sources are, the dollar amounts, and how they break down and how they're used and for which purposes. As far as the cost benefit. You know, all that we do is to work to ensure that the use of water is sustainable, and we try to use the best available data to help us to get to that place. So I think that's up to you all as to the benefit of it's the mission that we've been given by the legislature and the statutes.
Okay. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in quick follow-up to that, this is my formal request for that information, and I do want an answer as to the return on investment. As you know, the water users across the state encountered a large increase in their water fees, and for the agency not to be able to share to Minnesotans what their return on investment for their additional money that they have provided to the agency, frankly, is unacceptable. So we need to have that information. And in addition to that, taxpayers want to know how much money is going to this end. So please evaluate your different funding mechanisms for your groundwater management so that we can all gain a clear picture as to what this looks like statewide. Thank you.
Next, I've got Representative Finke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm learning something today, so I would just like to hear from our friends at the DNR, you know, what you make of Representative Schultz's comments about the creek. I'm not familiar with the creek and its history of whether or not it has drought in it, so I'd love to know.
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the question. We've spent 10 years meeting with the local stakeholders and going over lots and lots of data and analyses and conversations. So at the risk of over-summarizing, I will attempt to do it fairly briefly. Representative Schultz pointed out that the fisheries management goals and practice for Little Rock Creek is to manage it as a trout stream. So it's designated as a trout stream, and it's been stocked, and some years it has reproduction and some years it doesn't. And it's been going on for a number of decades. I don't have the exact date in front of me. The matter of whether or not the use of groundwater is impacting Little Rock Creek ecosystem is not just as simple as whether it's a trout stream or whether there's trout there or whether it's managed for trout. What we did to evaluate the impact to the ecosystem was to evaluate the habitat of all species of fish that live in Little Rock Creek, the native species of fish, including the trout that are there. And what we did was use a groundwater model to determine how much of the stream's flow was not getting to the creek during these periods of intense use of water that we've authorized. I mean, the DNR has authorized these folks to do this. So we have a groundwater model that shows us how much water is not getting to the creek. And then we've used industry standards, you know, practice science about how that's affecting the aquatic habitats. We did some very intensive field measurements. We had members of the Little Rock Creek watershed standing on the banks watching us do this work. And this has been going on for a number of years. So it's all well documented on our website. I'm happy to, you know, share some resources and point you to some things. But at the end of the day, whether Little Rock Creek is a trout stream or not a trout stream, managed for trout, not managed for trout, the habitat impacts are beyond just trout. And our belief is that the evidence supports that it does not meet the sustainability standards in Minnesota statutes. However, as we've told this to the irrigators, we've also said we understand that this use of water is important. And we've been meeting with them now for several years to explore the variety of options and alternatives, things that could be done to mitigate those impacts. Maybe it's moving some wells. Maybe it's adding some storage of water, constructing some ponds to infiltrate more groundwater. There's a whole host of things that we're in the process of evaluating that the irrigators have asked us to evaluate, including different crop rotations. So we're trying to figure out what the options are and what it would take. A little over a year from now, we should have some reasonable initial cost estimates that they can look at and figure out, well, which of these things might work the best for us, for our community.
Rep. Finke. Okay. Next, I've got Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, testifiers, for your testimony today. I've just got a few, kind of a series of questions, kind of generally about, you know, large water usage, groundwater usage. So I guess the first question I would ask, actually just to set the stage, is because we're having a lot of discussions around and competing discussions around who should get to utilize our groundwater resources in our state, which are in many instances plentiful but not limitless. And so the first question that I would have is, you know, under what circumstances or when would the DNR find it prudent to not issue a permit to a large water user?
Mr. Purcell or, excuse me, Mr. Meckel or Ms. Considine? Ms. Considine.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'll give you an example of a situation. About 10 years ago, we received, maybe 14 years ago, I'm losing track of time, we received a permit application very close to a calcareous fen wetland in Norman County. And we determined that we determined through field testing and modeling that pumping those irrigation wells would draw down water levels in the calcareous fen. And our statutes say that calcareous fens may not be degraded wholly or partially. So that was a case where we denied that permit application. Another, so that's a case where it relates to ecosystem impacts, okay? Another example is in Traverse County, a large appropriator had applied for a permit for, I think, I wanna say 120 million gallons a year. This was about 5 years ago. And we looked at the aquifer ahead of time and we warned them. We said, look, this doesn't look good. We don't think this is gonna be able to pump 120 million gallons a year round. But they went ahead with the testing of the aquifer. And based on the results of the testing and the observations during the test and the modeling that was done afterward, we determined that that aquifer could not support 120 million gallons a year. In that case, the applicant decided to administratively withdraw their amendment. That is an option they have. But I think if they had pursued that at 120 million gallons, we likely would have denied it. So there's two examples. Does that help?
Representative Godfrey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for those answers. I appreciate that. And one of the concerns that, you know, that we have is that, you know, we can't always predict the future of what our groundwater supply is going to look like. And so I do wonder, this is kind of a two-part question, you know, what if an entity that has been approved for a water permit exceeds that water permit? What are the steps that the DNR takes in order to remedy that? And then the second question is, if based off of, you know, the testing, the science, the data over time, we find that a permit that had been previously issued is now in fact exceeding what is sustainable groundwater usage, what is the process that the DNR takes to try to remedy that situation? So apologies for the two-part question, but I would like both answered if possible. Thank you.
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for that question. Gosh, now I forgot the first part of the previously issued.
Rep. Godfrey, go ahead.
If they've gone over, yeah, so a violation. Okay. You know, our general approach is that sometimes there's good reasons why a permittee might go over a volume once. Something happened, maybe there was a leak in the system. You know, things can happen. So we just, like, normally it's, okay, you got our attention. Hey, we noticed this. What went on? Repeat and egregious violations. We now have, and it was a couple of years ago now, administrative penalty orders that the legislature authorized. We haven't actually had to use that yet. You know, but I'll say this, that during the drought periods that we've recently had, we are very aware that a large number of our appropriation permittees exceeded their authorized volumes. But droughts also present unique circumstances. But it is something that we have to wrestle with because it's not very feasible for us to go around chasing these authorized volumes. In many cases, they're not even metering the flow, so it's a question of establishing whether or not they actually did exceed. Most of the irrigation systems are just using an hour meter and a pump rating and telling us how much water they use. And we know that they're reasonably accurate most of the time. The second part of the question?
Representative Godfrey.
Yes, thank you, and thank you. The second part of the question is what happens if over time we find that a previously issued water permit or ground usage water permit is no longer sustainable based off of new science, new data.
Yes, Mr. Meckel. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for repeating it. So that gets into the what Ellen was describing about water use conflict. So in that scenario, if we've determined that the sustainable amount is whatever that number is, then we have to look at the combination of users, and we have to make sure that all the domestic uses are going to be protected. So what amount is that, and is it a reasonable amount? The next thing would be the lower priority uses. And what's challenging about that is that if you're a municipality, okay, let's just take the city of Warren as an example. Well, most of the water that they're sending to the homes is being used for domestic consumption. But some of that water is maybe used outside for lawn watering. And that's considered a non-essential, and it's a lowest priority use. So before you would get to the position of telling an agricultural irrigator nearby that they have to cut back, you have to tell the city, hey, your residents are going to have to cut back on your lawn watering. I'm sure Representative Fisher could tell you all about the fun we're having with lawn watering in the North and East Metro and how challenging that is. And I don't mean to make light of this, but we are experiencing this for the first time in the state of Minnesota. We are in uncharted territory. We don't have examples. We don't have case law. We don't have lots of situations where we've done this. So we're trying to work through these issues with stakeholders, like aforementioned with Little Rock Creek. Let's see if we can find some options. They might be expensive, but let's see if we can find some options. The North and East Metro, you'll hear more about this from Met Council, exploring all kinds of options. In the city of Warren, some of the places where Ellen and her staff have worked with individual parties to figure out, okay, well, how can we supply the dairy but also keep the irrigation going for the feedstocks that are feeding the dairy, right? Like, how can we work that out? And, you know, in some cases it's a little easier. The more parties we have involved, the more variety of uses, the more difficult that gets. But it is helpful to be able to explain to people where they sit on the priority list.
Thank you, Mr. Meckel. Representative Gottfried, and then after that, I've got five others on the list.
Yep, I will not take up much more time. No, I appreciate I appreciate that explanation, and you know, I've been pretty clear about you know where I stand as far as the maintaining our natural resources, and that you know we want to make sure that we are providing the resources to folks that need them to grow our economy and stuff, but we need to do it in a sustainable way. And water is our most natural, is our most precious resource that we have in this state, and I think soon that will be seen throughout the world. And I want to make sure that the DNR is armed with the tools that they need in order to accurately evaluate water usage, and also enforce the permits that we have on file, and then also to change them if we need to down the road too. So I guess I would ask, in the context of this whole thing, if we need to make it more strict down the road, if we end up seeing more drought conditions, that the DNR provide us a list of things that they actually need in order to, as I said, more accurately review what is actually being drawn from groundwater supplies, and if there are more enforcement mechanisms that the DNR needs in order to make sure that we are continue to sustainably use our groundwater resources, that they would provide that list to the legislature. Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you.
Next, we'll go to Representative Purcell. And keep in mind, we have several others and more presentations yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of to build on what Representative Gottfried was asking, so I have a simple question that I'm thinking about this hierarchy of usage. Is that the same hierarchy that the DNR applies to when there are permits being requested?
Would that be Mr. Meckel? Would you be able to answer that?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and members, thank you. Jason Meckel for the record. So when we get a permit application, the first question is the amount of water that's being asked reasonable, and then is there water available? And Ellen talked all about the ways in which we go to evaluate that. But we don't get a situation where this is not what you're saying, but I'll use it to illustrate, where we say, hey, guess what? We've discovered there's 100 million gallons of water that's available here. Who would like to use it? And then we get applications, and then we look at the priorities, right? It doesn't work that way. What we get is permits that are issued 30 years ago, 50 years ago, that are continuing on today, and then new ones come in and new applications come in. Some do go away, but oftentimes they just continue to perpetuate and get renewed on an annual basis. So in Western water law, it's a first-in-time, first-in-right scenario. We don't have that in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. We have riparian rights. Everybody's entitled to and can use up to 1 million gallons a year if you can find it on your property or underneath your feet without a permit. Anything above and beyond that is by permit issued through us. That's the responsibility that we have. But we're not, unless we get them and we go like, okay, we've got two and they're competing and there's not enough. And that rarely happens. They usually come in staggered ways. There's staggered time frames.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that clarification. I think I'm also wondering, so some of the modeling that, like, I have been a part of One Watershed, One Plan, it's often a look back. And so I'm wondering if you have modeling or some kind of accommodations that you're making to, you know, we started with some slides about extreme wet and extreme dry. Are you, when you are looking at this modeling, are you able to predict forward for how we have seen rainfall, for example, change over time? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You want to go first? Ms. Considine?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll give it a go, and we'll see if Jason wants to chime anything in. So when we evaluate permit applications, we evaluate the peak, the maximum volume that they are asking for. So, for example, an appropriator in a typical year might use 50 million gallons, but they'll ask for 70, right, because they want enough to cover that drought situation. So we leave it up to the user to figure out what do they think they will need during a drought, and then that's the number that we evaluate. Did that answer the question?
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm wondering, that's kind of the statistics of the need, but I'm wondering if there is, like, as we're seeing that trend in the aquifer having less water in that, are we able to accommodate in the 21st century for the realities that we know are here and are probably going to be exacerbated in the future? It's just a very different reality than 50 years ago, perhaps, when some of the permitting and modeling happened. Thank you.
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. I think a little bit of what I would say is that, so it's a question of, can we reasonably expect the amount of rainfall that we're getting now and that we've been getting to be the kind of rainfall and then also aquifer recharge going forward into the future? And that, of course, requires a crystal ball. But some of the modeling that we do and that we've done, the Met Council with their modeling, can simulate different scenarios and ranges. We can put in different assumptions and say, well, what if this assumption were to happen? What would it look like? But I would come back to, it's more so the case that what's going to happen, the aquifer is going to be impacted more by the use of the water and the pumping. Like, if you look at the aquifer data that we have, the changes that we see are mostly because of pumping, not because nobody's pumping and we're just seeing changes in rainfall. Like, our rainfall, our recharges, you know, it varies from year to year, but it's pretty steady. It's the uses that are driving the aquifer levels more so. That's what we see in our data.
Okay. Thank you. Next, I'll go to Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. All right, this question is for Mr. Meckel, I believe. How does the state coordinate with counties and cities before imposing new groundwater restrictions? I think maybe it was touched on a little bit, but just wondered how you do that.
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the question. Sure. There's a number of ways that coordination interaction happens with local units of government. One example is in the groundwater management area. When we initiated the three groundwater management areas that we did, we reached out and invited representatives of counties and local governments and industry and the whole gamut. And in fact, it's all spelled out in statute that they're to be part of the process. So that's one way in which it happens. That's in a formal groundwater management area, and we have three of those. On permits, we always have the ability for local governments to comment on permits so they can let us know if there's, like an SWCD can let us know if there's a concern or an issue with a potential permit application. Some counties have taken on some groundwater management, like Dakota County, Washington County are two that I'm very familiar with. And there is exchange of information. But in terms of restrictions, and this is where I sort of need to ask the question of you, when you use the term restrictions, what did you mean in terms of restrictions?
Representative Gilman.
Thank you so much. Just basically, the agents, just wondering about the authority piece and the local water management district areas. If there's a restriction, we've talked about different ways that there's been restrictions imposed. I'm trying to think about which to get a, give an example that's in my, like, I've been in so many SWCD meetings and different things like that, and the Representative Purcell was talking about with the watershed plans. At times, there's just a directive that comes from the DNR. I'm just thinking of local governments that have opportunities to have more input, and they don't necessarily have a voice or a seat at the table. Even hearing Representative Schultz's example a little bit to me, if there's an ongoing thing like this, to me, that would be a perfect example of an ongoing issue that is happening. And what is the DNR's role? And then when do the local counties and government authorities get to have more input on a plan forward? That's where I'm coming. And would the agency be willing to do more work with that? I mean, I know there's working groups all over the place, so I hope that makes sense.
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair and members, just I'll specifically say on Little Rock Creek, the Soil and Water District and the county were all part of the planning process. They were invited to be at the table from day one. And that's just one example, and then I mentioned the other groundwater management areas.
Representative Gilman.
You're welcome.
Representative Jacob.
Well, thank you, Chair Fisher. When we were on page 16, you discussed about different wells that had actually run out of water. So do you only, are you only monitoring wells that are built to code, or are those just any well, like a Sandpoint, or how do you?
Ms. Constantine.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Anyone who lives in Minnesota, I have to walk myself through the process, so this, I'll try to make this quick though. Anyone can complain to the DNR that their well has been run out of water by somebody else, and the DNR investigates at no cost to that homeowner. One of the things we look for is whether the well has been constructed to code. And what our rules say, what the rules say is that if a well has not been constructed to code, but was run out of water because of nearby groundwater appropriation, the appropriator is responsible for restoring a water supply, but they are not responsible for the cost of bringing the well up to code. So if that, and it is, so it becomes, in real life, it is as confusing as I'm making it sound right now. What we find is that there usually is a negotiation between the appropriator and the private well owner, and they negotiate between the two of them what is an appropriate settlement. If they cannot reach a conclusion on that, then the DNR will weigh in, and we will consider that rule that says the appropriator is not responsible for the cost of bringing the well up to code.
Representative Jacob.
So it could, thank you, Chair Fisher. So it could be a completely substandard shallow well that you're reporting on here. When you give us the report, it says some wells have run out. It's not necessarily a well that's built to code, the information that you're presenting to us.
Ms. Constantine.
I assume that you're referring to the slide with the pink triangles on it?
Page 16.
Page 16. Jason, do you have that?
I don't have the page numbers. I think that's this
one. Okay. Okay. So those, the locations shown, if we're looking at the same thing, which I hope we are, page 16 of the slideshow shows wells, of the wells on the left figure in pink, almost all of those, I believe, except one or two, if I remember right, my brain gets a little fuzzy at 2021. Most of those wells were deep drilled modern wells. There were a handful that were not. And in 2022, I believe one or two of those wells may have been, no, in 2020, in 22, 2022, the figure on the left, all of those were deep drilled wells.
Representative Jacob.
Okay.
Last question that I'd like to get to.
One secondary question.
Yeah.
So if an aquifer runs through private property, how would you ensure that the landowner's privacy rights are protected while you're protecting the aquifer?
Ms. Considine?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So there is data. So when, I assume you're referring to someone who's filed a well interference complaint, when they file that complaint with us, that data becomes public information and they receive a Tennyson warning. So there is certain information that is always protected that is not public, but their name, their address, their landline phone number, those are public information.
Okay. Thank you. With that, we'll move on to Co-Chair Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for holding this hearing. I think it is expected that the state and legislators are watching water very closely. I think it was said earlier that water is arguably our most precious resource, and I think there's almost, if not universal, near universal belief that that's absolutely the case. I think they also expect us, Mr. Chair, to be smart about how we regulate water and how we work with communities. And we had some good examples and some good questions today that were brought up. Representative Schultz, I think your example is one that absolutely has to be considered. And when the legislature starts making decisions that impact communities like yours has been impacted, we need to elevate that so that we all have an opportunity to better understand each other's communities and to help those folks, because that impact can be severe. I also liked the question earlier of an example of a permit that had to be denied. I think it's important that there is a discussion around, well, what is the criteria? How does that decision come to be made, and so on? And so I'll just wrap by asking if there is an example that could be offered today, because there certainly was one that we discussed earlier where a permit had been denied. I'm wondering if there's an example of a permit that the agency worked with a community to try to move forward and find a solution. And there is certainly examples, Representative Schultz's community or others all through greater Minnesota that are really struggling. Their economies are dependent upon a project or an industry, whether it be agriculture or others. And there's all kinds of folks lined up to before and against, and that's a challenging environment for DNR to try to work through. And as we saw on the maps earlier, and we see even now, there are differences all over the state. We have areas where there's plentiful water, and we have areas where there's less, or maybe even significant challenges. And a one-size-fits-all approach just isn't going to work. And so we got to work on that, Mr. Chair. But if the agency could maybe speak to that and give me an example, I think that might be a nice balance to end with.
Mr. Beckel.
Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Heintzman, thank you for the question and the comments. Ellen's going to give a specific example, but I want to speak to what you're asking about more generally, which is, let me put it in other terms. In the 15 years that I've been in this division, we've denied 12 permit applications that I know of. Now, I could be wrong. Maybe there's one more. Maybe it's 13. It's not 20. It's 12. And I know most of them. And we've issued thousands. When we issue those thousands, many times they involve some back and forth, some conversation. The initial idea comes in. It's this. Through some discussion, through exploration, through fact-finding, that idea doesn't look like it could work, but this other similar idea could work. Volume of water, location of well. We do a lot to try to get to a yes answer with communities, with individual businesses. So I'll let Ellen give an example of one just to illustrate the point.
Ms. Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As we were talking, I realized I have two examples. I'll be quick. So the first I can think of, we received, of course, never at the same time because it's not that straightforward. We've received over the years two applications for ag irrigation near calcareous fen in central Minnesota. Forgive me, I don't remember the county. And the first the first permit, we were able to say, yep, that one should be okay. We think that one won't impact the fen. And then the second one came in, the second permit application. And we said, oh, we're a little worried about the two of you together, but we said, but we aren't sure. So we've been working with them, I think, for at least a year now we said, you know, if you could put in an observation well so we could actually understand what's happening here, that would help. So what they are moving toward is putting in an observation well so that we can monitor, because we don't know the geology at that site very well, so it's hard to predict what the aquifers will do. And we are moving toward issuing permits there by working together with those two appropriators to figure out where is our uncertainty, how can we close that gap. So that's a situation near a calcareous fen. Another case we're working on right now is in far northern Minnesota in Lake of the Woods County. It appears to be a very limited aquifer, but it is also a really valuable site for the producer and for the type of growing that they need to do. So we have been working with them to try to figure out if there's a volume that could be pumped. So they submitted their original application, and we just said, you know, that much volume this aquifer can't support. But there probably is a volume it can support. So let's work together and figure out what that could be. It does take time, but we know that it is really, you know, this in the case of that project, it's a unique location. It's important to them. It's really valuable for that project. So we're trying to figure out how we could make it work.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you both for your presentation today. It was very informative. One comment I'll add on the end is it was brought up during the presentation that a number of the counties don't have the county atlas done yet. That's a multi-year program that is funded through LCCMR, and that's one of the things that we still have a lot of work to do. We need to do that commitment to get those things funded to help guide this process in the future. So thank you, and with that, we will move on to our next presenter. We have from Met Council, I have Sam Paskey. And we're going to get the new PowerPoint up and going here. Okay, thank you for being here today. If you'd like to introduce yourself, who you're with, and begin your presentation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Sam Paskey, Assistant General Manager for Water Planning Services at the Metropolitan Council. And thank you for the opportunity to present today on the Council's role in regional water sustainability, our current Clean Water Fund projects, and the progress we are making with sub-regional planning in the White Bear Lake area. To start, I want to briefly ground us in what the council does and does not do when it comes to water supply. And following that, I'll share how we work with communities to shape policy and support local needs. The Met Council is the regional planning agency for the Twin Cities metro area and a provider of essential services like wastewater treatment and transit. Our mission is to foster efficient and economical growth. When it comes to water supply, our role is to convene, engage, collaborate, and provide technical guidance. We work with state agency partners and local government to ensure we have clean water for future generations. The Met Council is not a water supplier, and we do not permit or regulate water use. Permitting is the responsibility of the DNR and others, as we just saw. And we provide at the Met Council the regional collaboration framework, comprehensive planning coordination, and the technical tools that empower local communities to make the best, most sustainable decisions for their residents and businesses. Our water sustainability efforts are focused on maximizing existing infrastructure investments, promoting water conservation, balancing multiple water sources to meet water demand, supporting agency and community collaboration, as I mentioned, and protecting groundwater and surface water. This region requires access to clean, safe, and affordable water that is the result of many organizations working together. Our role, to that point, is to convene regulators, communities, and experts to guide policy and local decisions through the Metro Area Water Supply Advisory Committee, or MOSAC, and its Technical Advisory Committee, or TAC. The legislation that guides this work is in the middle of that slide. These committees include representatives from state agencies like the DNR, Department of Health, Agriculture, MPCA, as well as local communities, county representatives, and experts in hydrology and engineering. Their perspectives ensure policies on the use and safety of a limited resource reflect both state priorities and local boots-on-the-ground realities. A leader at one of the metro area communities, in fact, I think we even heard this comment within the committee today, observed that groundwater does not know community boundaries, and we can have a greater impact if we work together on water supply sustainability. That comment guides our work with communities at the Met Council. One of those core realities is that groundwater and surface water generally do not follow community boundaries, and jurisdictions do not align with hydrology. What one city does will affect the water quality and quantity of its neighbors. For example, water infiltrating into the ground in one city becomes drinking water for another community. Local conversations and collaboration between neighboring communities are essential to understanding the challenges and identifying workable solutions for all the uses you see on this slide, as water is the most valuable resource supporting our communities, our recreation, our industries, commerce, and many things in Minnesota. It's valuable to us. One size does not fit all. I heard that comment earlier, and to support that, within the region, we have divided the region into 7 planning subregions for water coordination and integrated water planning. These subregions serve as a forum for local land use planners, water professionals, and utilities to identify shared challenges and co-create solutions. We host integrated water planning workshops to break down silos because true sustainability requires us to connect land use, wastewater, stormwater, and drinking water planning together. At our most recent meeting of all the 7 subregions together, just a few weeks ago, we had well over 100 people in attendance to learn from each other and prioritize ways to solve water challenges. The input from these community representatives and water professionals guides our work at the Met Council to provide data and decision support tools that can be used by all of the communities in the metro area. That support work is largely made possible by the Clean Water Fund. For the fiscal years 2026 and 2027, the Met Council received $1.4 million from the Clean Water Fund to provide water efficiency grants and a $2.7 million appropriation for the Water Sustainability Program. These programs deliver valuable benefits. For example, through our Water Efficiency Grant Program, 100% of which pass through to end users, we have helped communities issue $2.7 million total to date in rebates for things like smart irrigation controllers, efficient appliances, and efficient toilets. This has resulted in an estimated savings of 260 million gallons of water so far, and more efficient appliances continue to save water year after year. The Water Sustainability Program overall addresses emerging drinking water supply threats and overall water sustainability through the focus areas on this slide that were included in the appropriation language. It helps communities plan ahead and use water wisely, authorizing work to help communities link land use to water plans, identify the best sources of water for the need, like reuse, analyze infrastructure needs, support planning for affordable water, make the case for funding and cost sharing for regional water projects, and invest in tools to address climate change impacts, like we learned about different climate and precipitation patterns, and promote groundwater protection through stormwater reuse grants. One example within this program is our partnership with the University of Minnesota's Technical Assistance Program, or MNTAP. The Met Council has funded 53 MNTAP interns who work directly with local businesses to identify industrial and commercial water savings. To date, this program has identified opportunities to reduce regional water consumption by an estimated 1.4 billion gallons. Clean Water Funds also support technical modeling. We are currently updating the Region Scale Metro Model 3 to version 4. The tool will identify future groundwater limitations and interactions with surface water, allowing communities to grow with more foresight. We are also publishing a water supply planning atlas, which gives local communities a visual geographic data set to make informed comprehensive planning and wellhead protection decisions. We are addressing emerging challenges as well. By the end of this year, we will be releasing guidance for local communities on high volume water use development. As data centers or biofuel facilities or advanced manufacturers look to locate in Minnesota due to our perceived or real water abundance, we are providing local planners with the tools to balance economic development decisions with other water needs. And finally, I want to update you on the North and East Metro Comprehensive Plan project for the White Bear Lake area. In 2023, the legislature directed the Met Council to develop a plan to ensure communities in this area have sufficient drinking water for growth while sustaining surface and groundwater resources. This is a significant collaborative effort involving state agencies, St. Paul Regional Water Services, and 14 local communities. We are actively evaluating over 15 different technical studies. I'm on slide 15 in your handout because I know this slide is not readable at all. Ranging from stormwater reuse and lake augmentation to conveying treated surface water from St. Paul or shifting municipal wells to protect the lake and support the growing communities in that part of the region. This shows the progress with those studies toward achieving the endpoint of presenting the results to the legislature in June 2030. We're on track to do that. We have executed and secured contracts for the technical and financial analysis. That work is underway, and the work group of communities listed on the previous slide is meeting regularly to evaluate these options, including the costs, infrastructure needs, and hydrologic impacts. Looking forward to the future, the Met Council is excited to continue working with our state and local partners to ensure we can meet these challenges together. Thank you for your time and your support, and I am standing for any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Paskey. I know I've got a couple of questions. I'm looking to see if anybody else does first, not seeing any. As the different communities are putting together their water supply plans, how much work and examination of the plans are being considered when they are addressing the situation if they have an emergency where they lose their current water supply? And as an example, all of a sudden somebody's well becomes contaminated or something breaks down. I know some communities are not well connected, so how is that connected and how is that being addressed in their water supply plans?
I'm going to ask
call a friend.
A more knowledgeable colleague than me who works with the communities more directly in that area, Jennifer Kostrowski, to join me at the table, and perhaps together we can work on that question.
Hi, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and give the first attempt at answering the question.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. My name is Jennifer Kostrowski. I'm the Assistant Manager of Water Policy and Planning for Environmental Services at the Metropolitan Council. That's a very good question. And I think that this is something we are concerned about as we are thinking about water challenges in the future. I wish we could tell our communities that your water supply will be secure forever going into the future, and that's just not the reality. And so we do offer, through our guidance, through our planet materials, and through our other resources that we're helping communities pull together their planning documents, some of those scenarios that we encourage them to engage with and plan for. And again, this is part of the process that local communities do take on as they are thinking about their water supply plans and then their bigger comprehensive plan process. When the comprehensive plan comes back through, we do get to offer advisory comments. And that is one area that I think that we will be trying to ensure. We don't have the statutory requirement. It is not a minimum requirement for our plan, but it is something that we do want to make sure that locals are having that conversation through the planning process.
Do you have an idea what percentage of the plans that come through, the water supply plans that come through that have a provision that's actually spelled out as if something happens?
Representative Fisher, not off the top of my head, but that is something that I can get back to you.
If you could, I would appreciate it. And folks, part of the reason I bring this up is
as an example, is the city of Minneapolis has their water supply basically from the Mississippi River. If something were to happen, they only have a 3-day supply of water available to them. They are on not other good interconnections. I know that in St. Paul, their water regional system, they've got like a 45 to 50 day supply of water in their reservoir system. And additionally, they have wells that in an emergency that they could tap to pump. And so some communities I know have done very good work where they interconnect, where they've got an interconnect that they can turn on between when they lose one of their main supplies, but some of them don't. Some of them are quite isolated. Some of them are very close to the core cities don't do much. And this is the reason I bring it up, because when something goes wrong, people need to have availability for water, and it can cause quite large problems quite quickly. So that is one of them I hit on. And then the other thing that I wanted to hit on a little bit is, we know the work is going on out in the Northeast Metro. And I know that one of the challenges out there is that there's a limit as to how much water there is. As an example, it's also a region that's supposed to continue to grow. And it seems that we're going to have issues for the foreseeable future coming out of the aquifer, and they're looking at for additional solutions. I do know there's some temporary things that have been put in place, like for the city of Lake Elmo temporarily to try to buy time. But as you folks are looking at it, what are some of the things that you're seeing out there? What are some of the items that you think might be moving forward to help address those, where we can still have growth and the water to take care of that?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'll start, and then maybe we'll add some more perspective from Jen. I will never forget around 2015, when I was new in my role. I still feel a little new in my role with the issues we're facing as a region and maybe as a state. We were meeting in the city of Hugo. Hugo and many of the communities in that area had decided to, not just decided to, but knew working together was the way to deal with these emerging challenges at that time. So now 11 years ago or even longer. And the meeting was called the Hugo Water Summit. And the challenge was, you could call it the White Bear Lake Challenge, but it's bigger than that. It's, is there enough water for growth? And the general sentiment was, we'd been growing as if there is enough water for growth. That was the assumption for many years, generations even. And now we're wondering, was that assumption correct? And how do we know? One of the attendees at that meeting, Representative Runbeck, said, isn't that the Met Council's job to make sure that we don't grow in a way that backs us into a corner with water supply? That's a very simple statement, but it is a profound question. Whose job is it? And at the end of the day, we believe it's all of our job to figure this out, similar to the way the DNR was, how they approach permitting. So that's the work we're doing in the North and East right now, to bring all the concerns to the table and the interests, and try to identify what does the future look like, what growth patterns can we know or can we anticipate, and where does that work best? We don't have the crystal ball, but we do have tools, and we can look at patterns and learn from what the modeling can tell us, knowing that modeling is never perfect, but it's getting better, and what development looks like. But the conversation is the most important piece, and I know you're involved in, deeply involved in ongoing conversations right now. Hopefully we can build the trust between the state level, the regional level, and the local level, that we can work through these things together. Because the answers are, the questions are hard, but the answers are sometimes even harder. And we have to accept it together as a region. Jen, do you want to build
Ms. Kahn.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, committee members, I don't want to say, I don't want to put my thumb on any of those studies to say this is the winner, but I will say the efforts of water conservation and efficiency are going to be a part of the solution. We have the ability to use water more efficiently and not use it as much as we have in the past when we have been operating in a world of perceived abundance. And so I won't say which one of those, and it was actually 18 studies, not the 15, but 18 studies that we have for the White Bear Lake study. I don't know which one is the winner. We are still evaluating them, but some of those core concepts of perhaps we just don't need to use as much, or maybe we can use it smarter, that is going to be at the core of the work that we will probably promote through that report.
All right, very good. Thank you. Thank you so much, both of you, for your presentation. And I think this kind of gets back to what Mr. Meckel said earlier is we're in uncharted, you know, this is something we've not dealt with as a state before. And this is something that we are all wrestling with because we don't have a game book to follow. And this also gets, I think, some of the issues that were raised by, I think it was Representative Gilman, is who all gets involved. And you'll see on this level is you've got the DNR actively involved with the Met Council, and you've got, you know, every single different community involved with, you've got the county involved with, because these are uncharted territories. And at the same time, everybody has, as you said, Ms. Paskey, everybody has a responsibility. And I think by working together, we'll find the right answer for that area. And I want to caution is the answers that we may find there may not be the right answers or even the right tools for other parts of the state. And that's one of the things that we have to always keep in mind is that what we need is a very wide, robust toolbox so that we have many tools so that we can have the right tool for the right part of the state that we're working with. So I want to thank everyone that's been part of this discussion today. And with that, we will move on to our next discussion here. Give me a second to find my sheet. Next, we're going to have the DNR presentation on community tree planting grants. If we could have them come forward, please. Oh, here it is. And as we get started, we are running a little bit behind time right now, so I would ask as we're getting these next presentations if they could be consolidated a little bit, and if we have questions, we can keep them very specific so that we can get through the rest of the presentations in the remaining 24 minutes here. And with that, I have Ms. Callahan, am I?
McClanahan.
McClanahan, thank you. Ms. McClanahan, if you'd like to introduce yourself, who you're with, and begin your presentation, please.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me, Chair Fisher and members. I really appreciate being here. My name is Valerie McClanahan, and I'm the Cooperative Forest Management Assistant Supervisor at the Department of Natural Resources. And I will be providing an update on the community tree planting grants. So to start off, I want to give a bit of context. So EAB is spreading, is continuing to spread throughout the state of Minnesota. As of now, 59 counties have been confirmed. So the number of communities that are contending with standing dead ash is increasing, and residents are continuing to require support as removals, especially on residential property, can hold some really significant costs. In 2010, Minnesota's communities had an estimated 2.65 million ash. In an LCCMR grant, it allowed the DNR to conduct a 2020 rapid assessment that showed 1.74 million ash still remain in our community forests. So the community tree planting grants appropriated by the legislature will provide communities assistance throughout the state to address ash that pose public safety concerns and diversify canopy cover with a particular focus on priority areas. The legislature appropriated $5 million in 2024 and $900,000 in 2025 for a combined $5.9 million for community tree planting grants. These grants to the DNR focus on projects removing and replacing ash trees that pose significant public concerns, and projects located in Census Block Group with a supplemental demographic index score in the 70th percentile or higher within the state of Minnesota. Of the total amount, $300,000 was designated as a direct grant to the city of Northfield, and another $300,000 was dedicated as a direct grant to the city of St. Peter as a part of the 2024 appropriation. These direct awards are fully executed. The remaining $5.3 million went out as a request for applications, which opened on August 13th, 2025, and closed on October 27th, 2025. We received 52 applications requesting $10,858,045. And the applications were received from a tribal government, several municipalities, some counties, and a park and recreation board in a city of the first class. Applicants came from across the state, from Manoman to Wells, and came from cities as large as 100,000 and several with less than 1,000 in population. With more than 10 million requested and only 5.3 million available, the applications demonstrate a continued and significant need for this assistance. All awardees received updated status notification by December 12, 2025. DNR is currently in process of the pre-award risk assessments before executing contracts. We anticipate contracts will be fully executed by April 15, 2026. DNR will share a list of awardees once all of the grant contracts have been finalized. That's when the information officially becomes public. Applicants applied for removing and replanting ash trees that cause public safety concerns, as well as planting for diversity. So eligible grant activities include removing and planting shade trees on public or tribal land to provide environmental benefits, replacing trees lost to forest pest disease or storms on public or residential, establishing a more diverse community forest better able to withstand disease and forest pests on public or residential. So this equates to removals and replanting available on public land, and only planting was available on residential land. Communities with grants in process are eager to get to work. However, some applicants are hoping for an extended grant period as the funds are set to expire on June 30th of 2027, giving grantees just over a year to implement grant work. DNR and communities statewide are consistently grateful for the support, as many would really not have the ability to address this issue without without the support. The significant public safety concerns have been the calls you get. It's just, oh, it's heartbreaking. So these funds are helping communities statewide address the public safety concerns and work to address the loss of canopy that EAB is having on communities across the state. So with that, thank you for your time. I believe that we're jumping to Met Council, or are we set for questions here?
I will pause for any questions right now. Okay. Not seeing anything. Thank you, Ms. Clanahan, and we'll jump to the Met Council.
Thank you.
Hi, welcome. If you'd like to introduce yourself, please, who you're with, and begin your presentation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Lisa Barajas. I'm the Executive Director of the Community Development Division at the Metropolitan Council, and community tree planting grants are one of the items that my division is responsible for. I am thankful for our partnership with the Department of Natural Resources, so I won't repeat a lot of the items that we have in common, but suffice it to say, the legislative direction is the same for what we are to prioritize in the Community Tree Planting Grant Program for the Twin Cities metropolitan area. So you'll see those here on the slide. That program purpose is directly outlined in statute. Program priorities are also outlined in statute, and you'll see those identified on the slide on specifically the geographies that are identified that follow a demographic index that is defined by the U.S. EPA, also defined in statute. Just wanted to illustrate those priority areas for you so you could see those more directly. And it's around census block groups in those areas. While those are the priority areas, that does not mean other areas are ineligible, but it's certainly one of the influencing factors as we reviewed applications that we received. With the first appropriation, this was the timeline that we had moving through the appropriation from May of 2024. Our Metropolitan Council, the fact that we have a policy board means that we have to bring things to our council for their authorization, including the development of our notice of funding availability, directing us on how to set up the program and define eligibility, as well as then receiving recommendations from our review panel of subject matter experts, including our colleagues at the Department of Natural Resources and others, for recommendations on grant awards. And then our governing body at the Metropolitan Council then makes the takes the official action and steps to approve those award recommendations. We then executed grant agreements after that through the summer and into the early fall of 2025. This is just some of our evaluation criteria that we had used, actually a high level summary of the evaluation criteria that we used. Similar to the DNR, we received way more requests for funding than we had funding available. So it was good to have evaluation criteria in order to select among some very worthy applicants. Just for a little bit of detail on the project overview, we're really looking for applications to demonstrate readiness to take on the project and their proposed scope, and a commitment and capacity to maintain and care for planted trees, as we're well aware that how the high mortality rate for trees in that first and second year after planting. So incredibly important that we see that capacity to ensure that the investments are living and having the impact that we seek to have in the region. High level summary here, as I mentioned, we received requests for funding that were more than double than what the funding we had available. Like DNR had mentioned, really just demonstrating both the need for the funding, demand amongst local governments as well, both to get ahead of issues within their communities as well as to address issues that they are already have been seeing and experiencing and ensuring that they can recover from infestations of emerald ash borer, where they may have already removed trees and are now trying to do additional work like removing stumps and replanting in addition to other work. As I mentioned, we had internal and panel review. Our first review process was ensuring that applications were complete and that we had the information we needed, following up with applicants where we might have had questions so that we were giving everybody a fair shake in the process, and then going through a scoring process with a six-member review panel. You can see those members or the representatives here on the slide. Really was a great opportunity to bring both sort of that policy orientation of are we accomplishing our goals, along with the subject matter expertise from partners across the region to the process. On this slide, you'll see the list of funded projects that came out of that 2020 for appropriation of the 25 process that we ran, and you can see that they range across communities within the metro area in size and geography. The last award on this slide is a direct appropriation that was a part of our 2024 appropriation, so they didn't actually apply since they were directly awarded through that process. So I just wanted to make note of that, but you can see a broad range here. We were really pleased with the quality of the applications we had seen. Communities had clearly been spending time thinking about how they were going to maintain, expand, and diversify their canopies within the region or within their communities. And we really wanted to ensure that communities of all capacities and sizes, recognizing that some of our cities don't have an urban forester on staff per se, certainly may have a need for urban tree canopy maintenance. We wanted to ensure that all communities of different capacities and sizes had the ability to access these funds. And we were thankful to see the number of different communities that did apply.
Our expected outcomes, what you see on this slide, on the number of trees to be planted, the geography in which they are planned to be planted, really represents a minimum. As we are hearing from communities as they're getting started, they're finding that they may have actually capacity to do more with the funds that they've been awarded in terms of the number of trees to be planted. So certainly as we work through these grants and communities are getting that work done and we're able to close out those grants with them, we'll be able to update this to see what was the impact. But certainly at the beginning here, we're seeing just that breadth of impact and are really pleased to see that to happen with these awards. As we look forward and plan for our next appropriation that we already have in hand and are looking to make available in this calendar year, we are taking what we've learned from the first round of awards and applying those lessons to the second round, looking again to increase the ease of accessibility for a variety and range of communities across the metro area. Continue our alignment and cooperation with the DNR to ensure that we don't have weird differences in programs, but the expectations are similar there as well. And then really thinking about how we better address program priorities that are outlined in state statute around the different geographies that we should be prioritizing, since we had a pretty even playing field across those program levels. So some of those things we might show up in as different adjustments in how we award points to the different criteria in our future round here. So for 2026, we are incredibly thankful for the additional appropriation from the legislature, that $1.9 million that's a split between GO bonds and general fund dollars that came out of the 2025 special session. Our anticipated timeline here is on our slide deck, and we are looking to initiate conversations with our governing body at the Metropolitan Council for program priorities and lessons, and to help address some of the lessons learned that I had on the previous slide and how we might adjust some of our award criteria. But essentially, we're looking to complete the council's review and approval of applications by the last quarter of this year and execute grant agreements for this work in early 2027, understanding that this gives our cities within the metro area the opportunity to purchase the things that they need to purchase and get their orders in order to be ready for the 2027 planting season. So with that, I am happy to take any questions you might have. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ms. Barajas, for your presentation. It's very informative. It's great to see the trees getting out there and the work that's been done so far getting things rolling. With that, are there any questions that I see around the table? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Barajas, I really like your presentation. It has a great amount of detail. And more importantly, it shows us that the Met Council, with a May 2024 appropriation, got it out in the summer of 2025. And you show us where it went and how it went and how much it went, and a lot of detail here. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I heard with the DNR appropriation where it went or if it's out until April 15th, almost 2 years after the appropriation was made. So I would congratulate you on your effectiveness, your efficiency, your transparency, and the ability to get projects done well.
Okay, very good. Any other comments? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to follow up, whether it's with you or it sounds like we need to talk to the DNR, just in regards to ensuring the result. And based upon that, under this Capitol Dome, a lot of focus is placed on program integrity and just the follow-up on it. And so to the extent to which you can continue to provide that to this committee is appreciated. And that the same is that same principle we have for every agency that's looking to help us have more trees.
Okay. Thank you. Not seeing any other comments at this point in time. Our next meeting will be this coming Thursday. Chair Co-Chair Heinzman will have the gavel. Is there any comments that you'd like to make at this point in time for the meeting?
I don't have anything specific, Mr. Chair. I think we'll have a good hearing. Today was great. We're off to the races again.
Sounds good. Thank you. And with that, we stand adjourned.